Connor felt it impolitic to display his anger openly. Susan Calvin was insisting. Why not, sir? It's obvious that the present situation is unfortunate. The only way we may reach results in the future, or what future is left us in this matter, is to separate the robots. We can't keep them together any longer. My dear Dr. Calvin, rumbled the general, his voice sinking into the lower baritone registers. I don't see how I can quarter 63 robots all over the place. Dr. Calvin raised her arms helplessly. I can do nothing, then. Nestor 10 will either imitate what the other robots would do, or else argue them plausibly into not doing what he himself cannot do. And in any case, this is bad business. We are in actual combat with this little lost robot of ours, and he's winning out. Every victory of his aggravates his abnormality. She rose to her feet in determination. General Colner, if you do not separate the robots as I ask, then I can only demand that all 63 be destroyed immediately. You demand it, do you? Bogart looked up suddenly and with real anger. What gives you the right to demand any such thing? Those robots remain as they are. I'm responsible to the management, not you. And I, added Major General Colner, am responsible to the World Coordinator, and I must have this settled. In that case, flashed back Calvin, there is nothing for me to do but resign. If necessary to force you to the necessary destruction, I'll make this whole matter public. It was not I that approved the manufacture of modified robots. One word from you, Dr. Calvin, said the general deliberately, in violation of security measures, and you would be certainly imprisoned instantly. Bogart felt the matter to be getting out of hand. His voice grew syrupy. Well, now, we're beginning to act like children, all of us. We need only a little more time. Surely we can outwit a robot without resigning, or imprisoning people, or destroying 2 million. The psychologist turned on him with quiet fury. I don't want any unbalanced robots in existence. We have one Nestor that's definitely unbalanced, 11 more that are potentially so, and 62 normal robots that are being subjected to an unbalanced environment. The only absolute safe method is complete destruction. The signal burr brought all three to a halt, and the angry tumult of growingly unrestrained emotion froze. Come in, growled Colner. It was Gerald Black, looking perturbed. He had heard angry voices. He said, I thought I'd come myself. Didn't like to ask anyone else. What is it? Don't orate. The locks of compartment C in the trading ship have been played with. There are fresh scratches on them. Compartment C, explained Calvin quickly. That's the one that holds the robots, isn't it? Who did it? From the inside, said Black laconically. The lock isn't out of order, is it? No, it's all right. I've been staying on the ship now for 4 days, and none of them have tried to get out. But I thought you ought to know, and I didn't like to spread the news. I noticed the matter myself. Is anyone there now? Demanded the general. I left Robbins and McAdams there. There was a thoughtful silence, and then Dr. Calvin said, ironically, Well? Colner rubbed his nose uncertainly. What's it all about? Isn't it obvious? Nestor 10 is planning to leave. That order to lose himself is dominating his abnormality past anything we can do. I wouldn't be surprised if what's left of his first law would scarcely be powerful enough to override it. He is perfectly capable of seizing the ship and leaving with it. Then we'd have a mad robot on a spaceship. What would he do next? Any idea? Do you still want to leave them all together, General? Nonsense, interrupted Bogart. He had regained his smoothness. All that from a few scratch marks on a lock. Have you, Dr. Bogart, completed the analysis I've required since you volunteer opinions? Yes. May I see it? No, Why not? Or mayn't I ask that either? Because there's no point in it, Susan. I told you in advance that these modified robots are less stable than the normal variety, and my analysis shows it. There's a certain very small chance of breakdown under extreme circumstances that are not likely to occur. Let it go at that. I won't give you ammunition for your absurd claim that 62 perfectly good robots be destroyed just because so far you lack the ability to detect Nestor 10 among them. Susan Calvin stared him down and let disgust fill her eyes. You won't let anything stand in the way of the permanent directorship, will you? Please, begged Colner, half in irritation. Do you insist that nothing further can be done, Dr. Calvin? I can't think of anything, sir, she replied wearily. If there were only other differences between Nestor 10 and the normal robots, differences that didn't involve the first law, even one other difference, something in impressionment, environment, specification. And she stopped suddenly. What is it? I've thought of something. I think. Her eyes grew distant and hard. These modified Nestors, Peter. They get the same impressioning the normal ones get, don't they? Yes, exactly the same. And what was it you were saying, Mr. Black? She turned to the young man, who through the storms that had followed his news had maintained a discreet silence. Once, when complaining of the Nestors' attitude of superiority, you said the technicians had taught them all they knew. Yes, in etheric physics. They're not acquainted with the subject when they come here. That's right, said Bogart, in surprise. I told you, Susan, when I spoke to the other Nestors here, that the two new arrivals hadn't learned etheric physics yet. And why is that? Dr. Calvin was speaking in mounting excitement. Why aren't NS2 models impressioned with etheric physics to start with? I can tell you that, said Colner. It's all of a piece with the secrecy. We thought that if we made a special model with knowledge of etheric physics, used 12 of them and put the others to work in an unrelated field, there might be suspicion. Men working with normal Nestors might wonder why they knew etheric physics. So there was merely an impressionment with a capacity for training in the field. Only the ones that come here, naturally, receive such a training. It's that simple. I understand. Please, get out of here, the lot of you. Let me have an hour or so. Calvin felt she could not face the ordeal for a third time. Her mind had contemplated it and rejected it with an intensity that left her nauseated. She could face that unending file of repetitious robots no more. So Bogart asked the question now while she sat aside, eyes and mind half closed. Number 14 came in, 49 to go. Bogart looked up from the guide sheet and said, "What is your number in line?" 14, sir. The robot presented his numbered ticket. "Sit down, boy." Bogart asked, "You haven't been here before on this day?"
"No, sir."
"Well, boy, we are going to have another man in danger of harm soon after we're through here. In fact, when you leave this room, you will be led to a stall where you will wait quietly till you are needed. Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir."
"Now, naturally, if a man is in danger of harm, you will try to save him."
"Naturally, sir."
"Unfortunately, between the man and yourself, there will be a gamma-ray field."
Silence.
"Do you know what gamma rays are?" asked Bogart sharply.
"Energy radiation, sir."
The next question came in a friendly, offhand manner. "Ever work with gamma rays?"
"No, sir."
The answer was definite.
"Hmm.
Well, boy, gamma rays will kill you instantly. They'll destroy your brain. That is a fact you must know and remember. Naturally, you don't want to destroy yourself."
"Naturally."
Again, the robot seemed shocked. Then, slowly,
"But, sir,
If the gamma rays are between myself and the master that may be harmed, how can I save him? I would be destroying myself to no purpose. Yes, there is that. Bogart seemed concerned about the matter. The only thing I can advise, boy, is that if you detect the gamma radiation between yourself and the man, you may as well sit where you are. The robot was openly relieved.
Thank you, sir. There wouldn't be any use, would there?
Of course not. But if there weren't any dangerous radiation, that would be a different matter.
Naturally, sir. No question of that.
You may leave now. The man on the other side of the door will lead you to your stall. Please wait there. He turned to Susan Calvin when the robot left. How did that go, Susan?
Very well, she said dully.
Do you think we could catch Nestor 10 by quick questioning on etheric physics?
Perhaps, but it's not sure enough.
Her hands lay loosely in her lap.
Remember, he's fighting us.
He's on his guard. The only way we can catch him is to outsmart him, and within his limitations, he can think much more quickly than a human being. Well, just for fun, suppose I ask the robots from now on a few questions on gamma rays. Wavelength limits, for instance.
No.
Dr. Calvin's eyes sparked to life. It would be too easy for him to deny knowledge, and then he'd be warned against the test that's coming up, which is our real chance. Please follow the questions I've indicated, Peter, and don't improvise. It's just within the bounds of risk to ask them if they've ever worked with gamma rays. And try to sound even less interested than you do when you ask it. Bogart shrugged and pressed the buzzer that would allow the entrance of number 15. The large radiation room was in readiness once more. The robots waited patiently in their wooden cells, all open to the center, but closed off from each other. Major General Colner mopped his brow slowly with a large handkerchief while Dr. Calvin checked the last details with Black. "You're sure now?" she demanded, "that none of the robots have had a chance to talk with each other after leaving the orientation room."
"Absolutely sure," insisted Black. "There's not been a word exchanged."
"And the robots are put in the proper stalls?"
"Here's the plan." The psychologist looked at it thoughtfully.
"Mm-hmm." The general peered over her shoulder.
"What's the idea of the arrangement, Dr. Calvin?"
"I've asked to have those robots that appeared even slightly out of true in the previous tests concentrated on one side of the circle. I'm going to be sitting in the center myself this time, and I wanted to watch those particularly."
"You're going to be sitting there?" exclaimed Bogart.
"Why not?" she demanded coldly. "What I expect to see may be something quite momentary. I can't risk having anyone else as main observer. Peter, you'll be in the observing booth, and I want you to keep your eye on the opposite side of the circle. General Colner, I've arranged for motion pictures to be taken of each robot, in case visual observation isn't enough. If these are required, the robots are to remain exactly where they are until the pictures are developed and studied. None must leave. None must change place. Is that clear?"
"Perfectly."
"Then let's try it this one last time."
Susan Calvin sat in the chair, silent, eyes restless. A weight dropped, crashed downward, then pounded aside at the last moment under the synchronized thump of a sudden force beam. And a single robot jerked upright and took two steps and stopped. But Dr. Calvin was upright, and her finger pointed to him sharply. "Nestor 10, come here," she cried. "Come here. Come here." Slowly, reluctantly, the robot took another step forward. The psychologist shouted at the top of her voice, without taking her eyes from the robot, "Get every other robot out of this place, somebody. Get them out quickly and keep them out." Somewhere within reach of her ears, there was noise and the thud of hard feet upon the floor. She did not look away. Nestor 10
If it was, Nestor Ten took another step, and then, under force of her imperious gesture, two more. He was only 10 feet away when he spoke harshly, "I have been told to be lost." Another step. "I must not disobey. They have not found me so far. He would think me a failure. He told me, but it's not so. I am powerful and intelligent." The words came in spurts. Another step. "I know a good deal. He would think, I mean, I've been found. Disgraceful. Not I. I am intelligent, and by just a master, who is weak. Slow." Another step, and one metal arm flew out suddenly to her shoulder, and she felt the weight bearing her down. Her throat constricted, and she felt a shriek tear through. Dimly, she heard Nestor Ten's next words. "No one must find me. No master." And the cold metal was against her, and she was sinking under the weight of it. And then a queer, metallic sound, and she was on the ground with an unfelt thump, and a gleaming arm was heavy across her body. It did not move. Nor did Nestor Ten, who sprawled beside her. And now faces were bending over her. Gerald Black was gasping. "Are you hurt, Dr. Calvin?" She shook her head feebly. They pried the arm off her and lifted her gently to her feet. "What happened?" Black said, "I bathed the place in gamma rays for 5 seconds. We didn't know what was happening. It wasn't till the last second that we realized he was attacking you, and then there was no time for anything but a gamma field." He went down in an instant. "There wasn't enough to harm you, though. Don't worry about it." "I'm not worried." She closed her eyes and leaned for a moment upon his shoulder. "I don't think I was attacked exactly. Nestor Ten was simply trying to do so. What was left of the first law was still holding him back." Susan Calvin and Peter Bogart, 2 weeks after their first meeting with Major General Colner, had their last. Work at Hyperbase had been resumed. The trading ship with its 62 normal NS2s was gone to wherever it was bound, with an officially imposed story to explain its 2 weeks' delay. The government cruiser was making ready to carry the two roboticists back to Earth. Colner was once again agleam in dress uniform. His white gloves shone as he shook hands. Calvin said, "The other modified Nestors are, of course, to be destroyed." "They will be. We'll make shift with normal robots, or if necessary, do without."
"Good.
But tell me, you haven't explained. How was it done?" She smiled tightly.
"Oh, that. I would have told you in advance if I had been more certain of its working. You see, Nestor Ten had a superiority complex that was becoming more radical all the time. He liked to think that he and other robots knew more than human beings. It was becoming very important for him to think so. We knew that. So we warned every robot in advance that gamma rays would kill them, which it would. And we further warned them all that gamma rays would be between them and myself. So they all stayed where they were, naturally. By Nestor Ten's own logic in the previous test, they had all decided that there was no point in trying to save a human being if they were sure to die before they could do it."
"Well, yes, Dr. Calvin, I understand that. But why did Nestor Ten himself leave his seat?"
"Ah, that was a little arrangement between myself and your young Mr. Black. You see, it wasn't gamma rays that flooded the area between myself and the robots, but infrared rays. Just ordinary heat rays. Absolutely harmless. Nestor Ten knew they were infrared and harmless, and so he began to dash out, as he expected the rest would do under first law compulsion. It was only a fraction of a second too late that he remembered that the normal NS2s could detect radiation but could not identify the type. That he himself could only identify wavelengths by virtue of the training he had received at Hyperbase under mere human beings,
was a little too humiliating to remember for just a moment. To the normal robots, the area was fatal because we had told them it would be, and only Nestor 10 knew we were lying. And just for a moment he forgot, or didn't want to remember, that other robots might be more ignorant than human beings. His very superiority caught him. Goodbye, General. Escape. When Susan Calvin returned from hyperbase, Alfred Lanning was waiting for her. The old man never spoke about his age, but everyone knew it to be over 75. Yet his mind was keen, and if he had finally allowed himself to be made Director Emeritus of Research with Bogart as acting director, it did not prevent him from appearing in his office daily. "How close are they to the hyperatomic drive?" he asked. "I don't know," she replied irritably. "I didn't ask." I wish they'd hurry. Because if they don't, Consolidated might beat them to it. And beat us to it as well.
Consolidated? What have they got to do with it?
Well, we're not the only ones with calculating machines. Ours may be positronic, but that doesn't mean they're better. Robertson is calling a big meeting about it tomorrow. He's been waiting for you to come back. Robertson of U.S. Robot and Mechanical Men Corporation, son of the founder, pointed his lean nose at his general manager, and his Adam's apple jumped as he said, "You start now. Let's get this straight." The general manager did so with alacrity. "Here's the deal now, Chief. Consolidated Robots approached us a month ago with a funny sort of proposition. They brought about 5 tons of figures, equations, all that sort of stuff. It was a problem, see, and they wanted an answer from the brain. The terms were as follows." He ticked them off on thick fingers. $100,000 for us if there is no solution and we can tell them the missing factors. $200,000 if there is a solution, plus costs of construction of the machine involved, plus quarter interest in all profits derived therefrom. The problem concerns the development of an interstellar engine." Robertson frowned, and his lean figure stiffened. "Despite the fact that they have a thinking machine of their own, right?" "Exactly what makes the whole proposition a foul ball, Chief. Lever, take it from there." Abe Lever looked up from the far end of the conference table and smoothed his stubbled chin with a faint rasping sound. He smiled. "It's this way, sir. Consolidated had a thinking machine. It's broken."
"What?"
Robertson half rose.
"That's right. Broken. It's kaput. Nobody knows why, but I got hold of some pretty interesting guesses. Like, for instance, that they asked it to give them an interstellar engine with the same set of information they came to us with, and that it cracked their machine wide open. It's scrap. Just scrap now."
"You get it, Chief?" The general manager was wildly jubilant. "You get it? There isn't any industrial research group of any size that isn't trying to develop a space warp engine, and Consolidated and U.S. Robots have the lead on the field with our super robot brains. Now that they've managed to foul theirs up, we have a clear field. That's the nub, the, motivation. It will take them 6 years at least to build another, and they're sunk. Unless they can break ours, too, with the same problem." The president of U.S. Robots bulged his eyes. "Why, the dirty rats." "Hold on, Chief. There's more to this." He pointed a finger with a wide sweep. "Lanning, take it." Dr. Alfred Lanning viewed the proceedings with faint scorn, his usual reaction to the doings of the vastly better-paid business and sales divisions. His unbelievable gray eyebrows hunched low, and his voice was dry. "From a scientific standpoint, the situation, while not entirely clear, is subject to intelligent analysis. The question of interstellar travel under present conditions of physical theory is, vague. The matter is wide open, and the information given by Consolidated to its thinking machine assuming these we have to be the same, was similarly wide open. Our mathematical department has given it a thorough analysis, and it seems Consolidated has included everything. Its material for submission contains all known developments of Franciacci's space warp theory, and apparently all pertinent astrophysical and electronic data. It's quite a mouthful.
Robertson followed anxiously. He interrupted, "Too much for the brain to handle?"
Lanning shook his head decisively.
"No.
There are no known limits to the brain's capacity.
It's a different matter.
It's a question of the robotic laws. The brain, for instance, could never supply a solution to a problem set to it if that solution would involve the death or injury of humans. As far as it would be concerned, a problem with only such a solution would be insoluble. If such a problem is combined with an extremely urgent demand that it be answered, it is just possible that the brain, only a robot after all, would be presented with a dilemma where it could neither answer nor refuse to answer. Something of the sort must have happened to consolidate its machine.
He paused, but the general manager urged on.
Go ahead, Dr. Lanning. Explain it the way you explained it to me.
Lanning set his lips and raised his eyebrows in the direction of Dr. Susan Calvin, who lifted her eyes from her precisely folded hands for the first time. Her voice was low and colorless.
The nature of a robot reaction to a dilemma is startling, she began. Robot psychology is far from perfect. As a specialist, I can assure you of that. But it can be discussed in qualitative terms, because with all the complications introduced into a robot's positronic brain, it is built by humans and is therefore built according to human values. Now, a human caught in an impossibility often responds by a retreat from reality, by entry into a world of delusion, or by taking to drink, going off into hysteria, or jumping off a bridge. It all comes to the same thing, a refusal or inability to face the situation squarely. And so, the robot. A dilemma, at its mildest, will disorder half its relays, and at its worst, it will burn out every positronic brain path past repair.
I see, said Robertson, who didn't.
Now what about this information Consolidated's wishing on us?
It undoubtedly involves, said Dr. Calvin, a problem of a forbidden sort. But the brain is considerably different from Consolidated's robot.
That's right, Chief. That's right.
The general manager was energetically interruptive. I want you to get this, because it's the whole point of the situation.
Susan Calvin's eyes glittered behind the spectacles, and she continued patiently.
You see, sir, Consolidated's machines, their super-thinker among them, are built without personality. They go in for functionalism, you know. They have to, without U.S. robots' basic patents for the emotional brain paths. Their thinker is merely a calculating machine on a grand scale, and a dilemma ruins it instantly. However, the brain, our own machine, has a personality. A child's personality. It is a supremely deductive brain, but it resembles an idiot savant. It doesn't really understand what it does. It just does it. And because it is really a child, it is more resilient. Life isn't so serious, you might say. The robopsychologist continued. Here is what we're going to do. We have divided all of Consolidated's information into logical units. We are going to feed the units to the brain singly and cautiously. When the factor enters, the one that creates the dilemma, the brain's child personality will hesitate. Its sense of judgment is not mature. There will be a perceptible interval before it will recognize a dilemma as such, and in that interval, it will reject the unit automatically before its brain paths can be set in motion and ruined.
Robertson's Adam's apple squirmed.
Are you sure now?
Dr. Calvin masked impatience. It doesn't make much sense, I admit, in lay language, but there is no conceivable use in presenting the mathematics of this. I assure you, it is as I say.
The general manager was in the breach instantly and fluently.
So here's the situation, Chief. If we take the deal, we can put it through like this. The brain will tell us which unit of information involves the dilemma. From there, we can figure why the dilemma. Isn't that right, Dr. Bogart?
There you are, Chief. And Dr. Bogart is the best mathematician you'll find anywhere.
We give Consolidated a no-solution answer, with the reason, and collect 100,000. They're left with a broken machine. We're left with a whole one. In a year, two maybe, we'll have a space warp engine, or a hyperatomic motor, some people call it. Whatever you name it, it will be the biggest thing in the world.
Robertson chuckled and reached out.
Let's see the contract. I'll sign it.
When Susan Calvin entered the fantastically guarded vault that held the brain, one of the current shift of technicians had just asked it, "If 1.5 chickens lay 1.5 eggs in 1.5 days, how many eggs will 9 chickens lay in 9 days?" The brain had just answered, 54. And the technician had just said to another, "See, you dope." Dr. Calvin coughed, and there was a sudden, impossible flurry of directionless energy. The psychologist motioned briefly, and she was alone with the brain. The brain was a 2-foot globe merely, one which contained within it a thoroughly conditioned helium atmosphere, a volume of space completely vibration absent and radiation free, and within that was that unheard-of complexity of positronic brain paths that was the brain. The rest of the room was crowded with the attachments that were the intermediaries between the brain and the outside world, its voice, its arms, its sense organs. Dr. Calvin said softly, "How are you, brain?" The brain's voice was high-pitched and enthusiastic. "Swell, Miss Susan. You're going to ask me something. I can tell. You always have a book in your hand when you're going to ask me something." Dr. Calvin smiled mildly. "Well, you're right, but not just yet. This is going to be a question. It will be so complicated we're going to give it to you in writing. But not just yet. I think I'll talk to you first."
"All right. I don't mind talking."
"Now, brain, in a little while, Dr. Lanning and Dr. Bogart will be here with this complicated question. We'll give it to you a very little at a time and very slowly, because we want you to be careful. We're going to ask you to build something, if you can, out of the information. But I'm going to warn you now that the solution might involve, damage to human beings."
"Gosh."
The exclamation was hushed, drawn out. "Now you watch for that. When we come to a sheet which means damage, even maybe death, don't get excited. You see, brain, in this case, we don't mind. Not even about death. We don't mind at all. So when you come to that sheet, just stop, give it back, and that'll be all. You understand?"
"Oh, sure. By golly, the death of humans. Oh, my."
"Now, brain, I hear Dr. Lanning and Dr. Bogart coming. They'll tell you what the problem is all about, and then we'll start. Be a good boy now." Slowly the sheets were fed in. After each one came the interval of the queerly whispery chuckling noise that was the brain in action. Then the silence that meant readiness for another sheet. It was a matter of hours, during which the equivalent of something like 17 fat volumes of mathematical physics were fed into the brain. As the process went on, frowns appeared and deepened. Lanning muttered ferociously under his breath. Bogart first gazed speculatively at his fingernails, and then bit at them in abstracted fashion. It was when the last of the thick pile of sheets disappeared that Calvin, white-faced, said, "Something's wrong." Lanning barely got the words out.
"It can't be. Is it dead?"
"Brain?" Susan Calvin was trembling.
"Do you hear me, brain?"
"Huh?" came the abstracted rejoinder.
"Do you want me?"
"The solution.
Oh, that. I can do it. I'll build you a whole ship, just as easy. If you let me have the robots. A nice ship. It'll take 2 months, maybe.
There was no difficulty?
It took long to figure, said the brain.
Dr. Calvin backed away. The color had not returned to her thin cheeks. She motioned the others away. In her office, she said, I can't understand it. The information as given must involve a dilemma. Probably involves death. If something has gone wrong.
Bogart said quietly, the machine talks and makes sense. It can't be a dilemma.
But the psychologist replied urgently, there are dilemmas and dilemmas. There are different forms of escape. Suppose the brain is only mildly caught. Just badly enough, say, to be suffering from the delusion that he can solve the problem when he can't. Or suppose it's teetering on the brink of something really bad, so that any small push shoves it over.
Suppose, said Lanning, there is no dilemma. Suppose Consolidated's machine broke down over a different question, or broke down for purely mechanical reasons.
But even so, insisted Calvin, we couldn't take chances.
Listen, from now on, no one is to as much as breathe to the brain. I'm taking over.
All right, sighed Lanning. Take over, then. And meanwhile, we'll let the brain build its ship. And if it does build it, we'll have to test it.
He was ruminating.
We'll need our top field men for that.
Michael Donovan brushed down his red hair with a violent motion of his hand and a total indifference to the fact that the unruly mass sprang to attention again immediately. He said, call the turn now, Greg. They say the ship is finished. They don't know what it is, but it's finished. Let's go, Greg. Let's grab the controls right now.
Powell said wearily, cut it, Mike. There's a peculiar overripe flavor to your humor at its freshest, and the confined atmosphere here isn't helping it.
Well, listen. Donovan took another ineffectual swipe at his hair. I'm not worried so much about our cast-iron genius and his tin ship. There's the matter of my lost leave. And the monotony. There's nothing here but whiskers and figures. The wrong kind of figures. Oh, why do they give us these jobs?
Because, replied Powell, gently, we're no loss if they lose us.
Okay, relax. Doc Lanning's coming this way.
Lanning was coming, his gray eyebrows as lavish as ever, his aged figure unbent as yet and full of life. He walked silently up the ramp with the two men and out into the open field where, obeying no human master, silent robots were building a ship.
Wrong tense. Had built a ship.
For Lanning said, the robots have stopped. Not one has moved today.
It's completed then?
Definitely, asked Powell.
Now how can I tell?
Lanning was peevish, and his eyebrows curled down in an eye-hiding frown.
It seems done. There are no spare pieces about, and the interior is down to a gleaming finish.
You've been inside?
Just in, then out. I'm no space pilot. Either of you two know much about engine theory?
Donovan looked at Powell, who looked at Donovan.
Donovan said, I've got my license, sir, but at last reading it didn't say anything about hyper-engines or warp navigation. Just the usual child's play in three dimensions.
Alfred Lanning looked up with sharp disapproval and snorted the length of his prominent nose.
He said frigidly, Well, we have our engine men.
Powell caught at his elbow as he walked away. Sir, is the ship still restricted ground?
The old director hesitated, then rubbed the bridge of his nose.
I suppose not. For you two, anyway.
Donovan looked after him as he left and muttered a short, expressive phrase at his back. He turned to Powell.
I'd like to give him a literary description of himself, Greg.
Suppose you come along, Mike.
The inside of the ship was finished, as finished as a ship ever was. That could be told in a single eye-blinking glance. No martinet in the system could have put as much spit and polish into a surface as those robots had. The walls were of a gleaming, silvery finish that retained no fingerprints. There were no angles. Walls, floors, and ceiling faded gently into each other, and in the cold, metallic glittering of the hidden lights, one was surrounded by six chilly reflections of one's bewildered self. The main corridor was a narrow tunnel that led in a hard, clatter-footed stretch along a line of rooms of no inter-distinguishing features. Powell said, "I suppose furniture is built into the wall. Or maybe we're not supposed to sit or sleep." It was in the last room, the one nearest the nose, that the monotony broke. A curving window of non-reflecting glass was the first break in the universal metal, and below it was a single large dial, with a single motionless needle hard against the zero mark. Donovan said, "Look at that," and pointed to the single word on the finely marked scale. It said, "Parsecs." And the tiny figure at the right end of the curving, graduated meter said 1,000,000. There were two chairs. Heavy, wide flaring, uncushioned. Powell seated himself gingerly and found it molded to the body's curves, and comfortable. Powell said, "What do you think of it?" "For my money, the brain has brain fever. Let's get out." "Sure you don't want to look it over a bit?" "I have looked it over. I came, I saw, I'm through." Donovan's red hair bristled into separate wires. "Greg, let's get out of here. I quit my job 5 seconds ago, and this is a restricted area for non-personnel." Powell smiled in an oily, self-satisfied manner and smoothed his mustache. "Okay, Mike, turn off that adrenaline tap you've got draining into your bloodstream. I was worried too, but no more."
"No more, huh?
How come no more? Increased your insurance?" "Mike, this ship can't fly."
"How do you know?"
"Well, we've been through the entire ship, haven't we?"
"Seems so."
"Take my word for it. We have. Did you see any pilot room except for this one port and the one gauge here in parsecs? Did you see any controls?"
"No."
"And did you see any engines?"
"Holy Joe, no."
"Well then, let's break the news to landing, Mike." They cursed their way through the featureless corridors and finally hit and missed their way into the short passage to the airlock. Donovan stiffened.
"Did you lock this thing, Greg?"
"No, I never touched it. Yank the lever, will you?" The lever never budged, though Donovan's face twisted appallingly with exertion. Powell said, "I didn't see any emergency exits. If something's gone wrong here, they'll have to melt us out."
"Yes, and we've got to wait until they find out that some fool has locked us in here," added Donovan, frantically.
"Let's get back to the room with the port. It's the only place from which we might attract attention." But they didn't. In that last room, the port was no longer blue and full of sky. It was black, and hard yellow pinpoint stars spelled space. There was a dull, double thud as two bodies collapsed separately into two chairs. Alfred Lanning met Dr. Calvin just outside his office. He lit a nervous cigar and motioned her in. He said, "Well, Susan, we've come pretty far, and Robertson's getting jumpy. What are you doing with the brain?" Susan Calvin spread her hands.
"It's no use getting impatient. The brain is worth more than anything we forfeit on this deal. But you've been questioning it for 2 months.
The psychologist's voice was flat, but somehow dangerous.
"You would rather run this yourself." "Now you know what I meant."
"Oh, I suppose I do." Dr. Calvin rubbed her hands nervously. "It isn't easy. I've been pampering it and probing it gently, and I haven't gotten anywhere yet.
Its reactions aren't normal. Its answers, they're queer somehow. But nothing I can put my finger on yet. And you see, until we know what's wrong, we must just
tiptoe our way through. I can never tell what simple question or remark will just push him over. And then... well, and then we'll have on our hands a completely useless brain. Do you want to face that?
Well, it can't break the first law.
I would have thought so, but... you're not even sure of that?
Lanning was profoundly shocked.
Oh, I can't be sure of anything, Alfred.
The alarm system raised its fearful clangor with a horrifying suddenness. Lanning clicked on communications with an almost paralytic spasm. The breathless words froze him. He said,
Susan, you heard that?
The ship's gone. I sent those two field men inside half an hour ago. You'll have to see the brain again.
Susan Calvin said with enforced calm, Brain? What happened to the ship?
The brain said happily, The ship I built, Miss Susan?
That's right.
What has happened to it?
Why, nothing at all.
The two men that were supposed to test it were inside, and we were all set. So I sent it off.
Oh. Well, that's nice.
The psychologist felt some difficulty in breathing.
Do you think they'll be all right?
Right as anything, Miss Susan. I've taken care of it all. It's a beautiful ship.
Yes, Brain, it is beautiful. But you think they have enough food, don't you?
They'll be comfortable.
Plenty of food.
This business might be a shock to them, Brain. Unexpected, you know.
The Brain tossed it off.
They'll be all right. It ought to be interesting for them.
Interesting? How?
Just interesting, said the Brain, slyly.
Susan, whispered Lanning in a fuming whisper, ask him if death comes into it. Ask him what the dangers are.
Susan Calvin's expression contorted with fury. Keep quiet. In a shaken voice, she said to the Brain,
We can communicate with the ship, can't we, Brain?
Oh, they can hear you if you call by radio.
I've taken care of that.
Thanks.
That's all for now.
Once outside, Lanning lashed out ragingly. Great galaxy, Susan. If this gets out, it will ruin all of us. We've got to get those men back. Why didn't you ask it if there was danger of death? Straight out.
Because, said Calvin with a weary frustration, that's just what I can't mention. If it's got a case of dilemma, it's about death. Anything that would bring it up badly might knock it completely out.
Will we be better off then?
Now look, it said we could communicate with them. Let's do so. Get their location and bring them back. They probably can't use the controls themselves. The Brain is probably handling them remotely. Come.
It was quite a while before Powell shook himself together. Mike, he said, out of cold lips, did you feel an acceleration?
Donovan's eyes were blank.
Huh?
No. No.
And then the redhead's fists clenched, and he was out of his seat with sudden, frenzied energy, and up against the cold, wide-curving glass. There was nothing to see but stars. He turned.
Greg, they must have started the machine while we were inside. Greg, it's a put-up job. They fixed it up with a robot to jerry us into being the tryout boys in case we were thinking of backing out.
Powell said, What are you talking about?
What's the good of sending us out if we don't know how to run the machine? How are we supposed to bring it back?
No, this ship left by itself and without any apparent acceleration. He rose and walked the floor slowly. The metal walls dinned back the clangor of his steps. He said tonelessly, Mike, this is the most confusing situation we've ever been up against.
That, said Donovan bitterly, is news to me. I was just beginning to have a very swell time when you told me.
Powell ignored that.
No acceleration. Which means the ship works on a principle different from any known. Different from any we know, anyway. Different from any known. There are no engines within reach of manual control. Maybe they're built into the walls. Maybe that's why they're thick as they are. What are you mumbling about? Demanded Donovan. Why not listen? I'm saying that whatever powers this ship is enclosed and evidently not meant to be handled. The ship is running by remote control.
The brain's control?
Why not?
Then you think we'll stay out here till the brain brings us back?
It could be. If so, let's wait quietly. The brain is a robot. It's got to follow the first law. It can't hurt a human being.
Donovan sat down slowly. You figure that?
Carefully, he flattened his hair. Listen, this junk about the space warp knocked out Consolidated's robot, and the Longhairs said it was because interstellar travel killed humans. Which robot are you going to trust? Ours had the same data, I understand. Powell was yanking madly at his mustache. Don't pretend you don't know your robotics, Mike. Before it's physically possible in any way for a robot to even make a start to breaking the first law, so many things have to break down that it would be a ruined mess of scrap 10 times over. There's some simple explanation to this.
Oh, sure, sure.
Just have the butler call me in the morning. It's all just too simple for me to bother about before my beauty nap. Well, Jupiter, Mike, what are you complaining about so far? The brain is taking care of us. This place is warm. It's got light. It's got air. There wasn't even enough of an acceleration jar to muss your hair if it were smooth enough to be mussable in the first place. Yeah? Greg, you must have taken the lessons. No one could put Pollyanna that far out of the running without.
What do we eat?
What do we drink? Where are we? How do we get back? And in case of accident, to what exit and in what spacesuit do we run, not walk? I haven't even seen a bathroom in the place, or those little conveniences that go along with bathrooms. Sure, we're being taken care of. But good? The voice that interrupted Donovan's tirade was not Powell's. It was nobody's. It was there. Hanging in open air, stentorian and petrifying in its effects. Gregory Powell, Michael Donovan. Gregory Powell, Michael Donovan. Please report your present positions. If your ship answers controls, please return to base. Gregory Powell, Michael Donovan. The message was repetitious, mechanical, broken by regular, untiring intervals. Donovan said, Where's it coming from? I don't know. Powell's voice was an intense whisper. Where do the lights come from? Where does anything come from? Well, how are we going to answer? They had to speak in the intervals between the loudly echoing, repeating message. The walls were bare and as unbroken as smooth, curving metal can be. Powell said, Shout an answer. They did. They shouted, in turns and together. Position unknown! Ship out of control! Condition desperate! Their voices rose and cracked. The short, business-like sentences became interlarded and adulterated with screaming and emphatic profanity, but the cold, calling voice repeated and repeated and repeated unwearyingly.
They don't hear us, gasped Donovan. There's no sending mechanism. Just a receiver.
His eyes focused blindly at a random spot on the wall. Slowly the din of the outside voice softened and receded. They called again when it was a whisper, and they called again, hoarsely, when there was silence. Something like 15 minutes later, Powell said lifelessly, Let's go through the ship again. There must be something to eat somewheres. He did not sound hopeful. It was almost an admission of defeat. They divided in the corridor to the right and left. They could follow one another by the hard footsteps resounding, and they met occasionally in the corridor, where they would glare at each other and pass on. Powell's search ended suddenly, and as it did, he heard Donovan's glad voice rise boomingly.
Hey, Greg, it howled. The ship has got plumbing. How did we miss it?
It was some 5 minutes later that he found Powell by hit and miss. He was saying, still no shower baths, though, but it got choked off in the middle.
Food, he gasped.
The wall had dropped away, leaving a curved gap with two shelves. The upper shelf was loaded with unlabeled cans of a bewildering variety of sizes and shapes. The enameled cans on the lower shelf were uniform, and Donovan felt a cold draft about his ankles. The lower half was refrigerated.
How?
It wasn't there before, said Powell, curtly. That wall section dropped out of sight as I came in the door. He was eating. The can was the preheating type with enclosed spoon, and the warm odor of baked beans filled the room. Grab a can, Mike. Donovan hesitated.
What's the menu?
How do I know? Are you finicky?
No, but all I eat on ships are beans. Something else would be first choice.
His hand hovered and selected a shining elliptical can whose flatness seemed reminiscent of salmon or similar delicacy. It opened at the proper pressure.
Beans, howled Donovan and reached for another.
Powell hauled at the slack of his pants. Better eat that, sonny boy. Supplies are limited and we may be here a long, long time. Donovan drew back sulkily.
Is that all we have? Beans?
Could be.
What's on the lower shelf?
Milk.
Just milk?
Donovan cried in outrage. Looks it. The meal of beans and milk was carried through in silence, and as they left, the strip of hidden wall rose up and formed an unbroken surface once more. Powell sighed.
Everything automatic. Everything just so.
Never felt so helpless in my life.
Where's your plumbing?
Right there.
And that wasn't among those present when we first looked, either.
15 minutes later, they were back in the glassed-in room, staring at each other from opposing seats. Powell looked gloomily at the one gauge in the room. It still said parsecs. The figures still ended in 1 million, and the indicating needle was still pressed hard against the zero mark. In the innermost offices of the U.S. Robot and Mechanical Men Corporation, Alfred Lanning was saying wearily, "They won't answer. We've tried every wavelength. Public, private, coded, straight. Even this sub-ether stuff they have now. And the brain still won't say anything?" He shot this at Dr. Calvin.
"It won't amplify on the matter, Alfred," she said emphatically. "It says they can hear us. And when I try to press it, it becomes, well, it becomes sullen. And it's not supposed to. Whoever heard of a sullen robot?"
"Suppose you tell us what you have, Susan," said Bogart.
"Here it is. It admits it controls the ship itself entirely. It is definitely optimistic about their safety, but without details. I don't dare press it. However, the center of disturbance seems to be about the interstellar jump itself. The brain definitely laughed when I brought up the subject. There are other indications, but that is the closest it's come to an open abnormality."
She looked at the others.
"I refer to hysteria. I dropped the subject immediately, and I hope I did no harm, but it gave me a lead. I can handle hysteria. Give me 12 hours. If I can bring it back to normal, it will bring back the ship."
Bogart seemed suddenly stricken.
"The interstellar jump. What's the matter?"
The cry was double from Calvin and Lanning.
"The figures for the engine the brain gave us. Say, I just thought of something."
He left hurriedly. Lanning gazed after him. He said brusquely to Calvin,
"You take care of your end, Susan."
2 hours later, Bogart was talking eagerly.
"I'll tell you, Lanning, that's it. The interstellar jump is not instantaneous, not as long as the speed of light is finite. Life can't exist. Matter and energy, as such, can't exist in the space warp. I don't know what it would be like, but that's it. That's what killed Consolidated's robot.